From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, screenwriter and director John Waters. His movie Cecil B. Demented has just come out on video and DVD. This comedy is about an underground film director who wages war on bad movies and the cineplexes that show them. He kidnaps a Hollywood star and forces her to be in his anti-Hollywood movie. Cecil B. Demented is even more outrageous than Waters in going to extremes to make a movie. We'll listen back to our interview with Waters, recorded last summer after the film's release. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Shadow of the Vampire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The Indian Army has joined the rescue effort in the search for people buried in this morning's massive earthquake. Indian authorities say more than 2,000 people were killed. The BBC's Jill McGivering says rescue efforts are hampered by poor communication systems in the country.
The difficulties with the communication system will in itself have really slowed things down. It's partly a difficulty for the other parts of India, the central government, when they're trying to assess the situation, when they're trying to prioritise, trying to work out which teams to send where and so on. Obviously, that task is made more difficult when they can't pinpoint the worst trouble spots. So it's obviously going to take a little time for things to get back to normal. But obviously, time is what the people haven't got here. Every hour counts in terms of survival when people are trapped inside debris.
The BBC's Jill McGivering reporting from Ahmedabad. The State Department has confirmed a report aired on NPR last night that Serbian soldiers incinerated the bodies of up to 1,500 ethnic Albanians in 1999 to cover up their deaths. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The report included interviews with members of Serbian security forces who participated in the incinerations, which took place in the blast furnace of a lead refinery in the town of Trepča in northern Kosovo. The men said they were acting under orders of senior commanders under then-Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher.
The information we have corroborates the general outlines of this report and corroborates the facts that Milosevic's forces did attempt to destroy evidence of their crimes, including at this place.
The 1,200 to 1,500 bodies incinerated at the plant account for half the number of missing Albanians in Kosovo. The report was produced by American Radio Works, the documentary unit of Minnesota Public Radio and NPR News. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
EgyptAir says it accepts liability but not blame for the 1999 plane crash that killed 217 people. 101 Americans were on board when the Boeing 767 plunged into the Atlantic off the coast of Massachusetts. The decision clears the way for relatives of the victims to collect damages. American investigators think the co-pilot may have deliberately put the plane into its fatal dive, but EgyptAir rejects that conclusion. The airline says controls on the airliner may have failed. President Bush said today he would honor a campaign pledge to reduce the U.S. nuclear arms arsenal. He suggested that reducing the American arsenal could affect the course of arms control talks with Russia. Noting that he's vowed to deploy a national missile defense system, the president said the U.S. can help create a safe world, both on the defensive side and on the offensive side. The Dow Industrials were down today 69 points, ending at 10,660 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq closed up 27 points at 2781. This is NPR News. 10 people died this morning near the junction of two interstates south of Chicago. A van crossed over the median and was hit by a truck. Light snow was falling at the time. From Chicago Public Radio, Jody Beckner reports.
No eyewitnesses to the crash that happened at about 9:30 this morning have come forward, but according to Illinois State Police, a Salvation Army minivan carrying 10 people going to visit relatives in prison crossed over the median and was broadsided by a truck. Police say it's difficult to identify the bodies because of the severe impact of the crash, and they're hoping anyone who saw the collision will help them reconstruct the scene. There was some snow on the ground, but the roads were mostly wet, authorities say. The drivers of both vehicles survived, but neither is in good enough condition to provide any details about how the crash occurred. For NPR News, I'm Jody Becker in Chicago.
The president of Kent State University in Ohio has vetoed a plan to arm campus police with the military M16 rifle. Students objected, saying it would be an insult to the memory of Vietnam War protesters gunned down at the school by National Guardsmen during campus unrest in 1970. Doctors say Baseball Hall of Famer Ted Williams is improving after open heart surgery and that his chances of survival are better than before. Williams is 82. He had surgery January 16th to repair a heart valve. His doctors say the next critical step is for him to begin talking, but they say that is just a matter of time. Newport News Shipbuilding of Virginia said today it has won a Navy contract to design and build the 10th Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. The design and construction contract is valued at about $3.8 billion. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Cecil B. Demented, and you're in my movie. You look in the camera and ruin a take, you're dead.
Do you know Quentin Tarantino? I love his movies.
No ad-libbing!
That's a scene from John Waters' comedy Cecil B. Demented, which has just been released on video and DVD. It's about a director who becomes a cinema terrorist, declaring war on mainstream movies and the cineplexes that show them. Cecil B. Demented is even more willing to go to extremes than Waters himself. Waters first became known for films that were shocking and hilarious in their bad taste. His 1972 film, Pink Flamingos, helped create the midnight movie phenomenon. His other movies include Polyester, Hairspray, Serial Mom, and Pecker. I spoke with Waters last summer when Cecil B. Demented was first released. In the film, director Cecil B. Demented sets out to make a movie that will destroy the movie industry. He kidnaps a spoiled Hollywood movie star, played by Melanie Griffith, and forces her to star in his new anti-Hollywood film. Cecil B. Demented is played by Stephen Dorff.
Now, our picture is called Raving Beauty. You play the insane owner of a failed art theater, who, along with her film fanatic boyfriend, Lyle, come on over, and her violence-prone daughter, Cherish.
Daughter?
Together. The three of you vow to start a revolution to destroy mainstream cinema.
I can't be in this movie.
You dare to tell Cecil B. Demented you refuse?
I am too young to play her mother.
I know how old you are.
All right, well, I just don't feel it. I just am not motivated.
How's this for motivation, huh?
Ow!
There are no creative differences on a Cecil B. Demented set, Miss Whitlock. You got that? One day you'll thank me for saving you from your bad career. Places!
John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
What crystallized the story for you, the story of an underground movie group dedicated to destroying commercial cinema?
Well, I had certainly some fondness of remembering the radical left-wing days of the 60s and how much, instead of going to a rave on a weekend, we went to a riot. So I didn't want to make a nostalgic movie. And I thought kids just don't get the 60s or what really happened then, especially in the political viewpoint of it. So I tried to take that and put it in a movie that maybe would be a very contemporary movie if cinema were politics, if there was cinema unrest, if people went to war over their taste in movies.
Oh, it just sometimes feels like, doesn't it?
It used to. It feels less and less like that because there's less and less genre theaters. I mean, there used to be theaters that only played karate movies. There was blaxploitation theaters. There were sexploitation theaters. There was family movie theaters. But that's really blurred now. You don't have that so much. So I always love the idea of those audiences at war with each other. So a city would be, you know, there would be cinematic tenseness in the air. And like they used to describe racially tense. I mean, there would be trouble brewing from different theater owners. And that to me would be really kind of an exciting way to live a life.
Well, Cecil B. Demented, the leader of this band of subversive underground filmmakers, says the Hollywood system stole our sex and co-opted our violence, so there's nothing left for our kind of movies. Did you ever feel that way yourself, that your kind of movie has been subverted?
Well, in a way, I guess I'm hypocritical because I am glad that happened. It has made my career a lot more easier to get my movies made because this has happened. So in some ways I'm criticizing, but I'm a big part of it because this movie was financed by Canal Plus, which is like a big studio in Europe. It's the biggest French production center. So Hollywood has stolen that, and they have made it the most popular kind of movies in the whole world. I mean, Hollywood is the real terrorist in the real world. We're putting every film business in each European country out of business because people would rather see our bad movies, really. So we're the terrorist. So and the people in each country are cooperating with us. They bitch about it and they moan about it, but they pay to see them.
What connections do you feel to Cecil B. DeMented?
Well, certainly there's some things that did happen to me in this. We used to run from the cops. We didn't know that you had to ask permission, and we would have to get out and run. People would chase us. We stole film to make movies before.
Where'd you steal it from?
A camera shop, actually. The leading lady worked in my first movie, and she stole the film and the developing. So the first movie cost zero, actually. The budget was zero. And I have that in there. Somebody says, in the song, no budget. They say, we have a budget of zero. So, but later, we didn't steal things, but we would illegally borrow them or pay people to sneak. At one film university, we got all the editing equipment and none of the students got to use it because I had paid off. That was the only way I could get it. So we were editing Female Trouble, but really none of the film students that were going to that school got to use the equipment they had paid to go. So there were some hard feelings. So you make a movie however you can in any such way. I think I'm different than Cecil in the fact that I had a sense of humor about myself. I wasn't willing to die to make a movie. And I cared what happened after we shot it. Cecil's so insane. There's no editor. You never hear him talk about post-production in a Cecil B. DeMented film. He's only alive when he's making the movie.
You also didn't kidnap a leading lady to star in your movies. But if you could have kidnapped a leading lady...
Well, in those
when
days...
When you're getting started, who would you have kidnapped?
Well, in the beginning, Jane Mansfield, but she was already dead, probably. But she was our really Divine and I's biggest influence at the time. Anita Ekberg, I still love. I would have maybe kidnapped Anita Ekberg. Or Jane Mansfield, certainly. And Divine was my Jane Mansfield. Or Elizabeth Taylor, certainly. Because Divine was my Elizabeth Taylor more than any. The original influence was Jane Mansfield, a blonde bombshell, but which Divine was in Mondo Trasho, but not one that weighed 300 pounds. But later, Elizabeth Taylor was Divine's certainly favorite idol. He even smoked Salem cigarettes because Elizabeth Taylor did. And I finally met Elizabeth Taylor last year. I was invited to her house for July 4th cookout because of her staff was fans of mine, not Elizabeth Taylor. And I think they told her to invite me. But it was great, and it was 2 days after, unfortunately, Princess Di had died, so there were, like, helicopters overhead, like, writing the stories, like, how dare Elizabeth Taylor have a party? And I didn't know what to do because it was outside, and the helicopters were right overhead, and everybody was pretending they weren't there, so I just covered my bald spot. That's all I figured to do for the photos. I knew they were taking photos directly above me. And I did talk to Elizabeth Taylor about how much I loved this movie she made that everyone else hates called Boom. And I show it at film festivals all around the world now. It's called John Waters Presents Boom. And it's based on the Tennessee Williams play, The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore. It's a great failed art movie directed by Joseph Losey, where she plays the richest woman in the world who's dying, and Richard Burton is the angel of death. So I immediately told her how much I love this movie, and she got mad because she thought I was making fun of her. She said, that's a terrible movie. But then I convinced her I wasn't. But I don't know. I still really like Elizabeth Taylor. I think beside all the great AIDS work she's done, she's really a real movie star. And Divine idolized her and unfortunately never got to meet her. Although Elton John had it set up where they were going to meet. He was taking Divine on this plane where Elizabeth was going to be and something happened. I don't know. But Elton John was very supportive of Divine and took him on stage in Madison Square Garden and stuff. So he was going to introduce them, and it didn't happen.
You mentioned Anita Ekberg.
Yeah.
Isn't she one of, like, the Hollywood painters now? Didn't she have, like, a painting show?
No, not, that's Gina Lollobrigida, and she's a photographer. But Anita Ekberg...
No.
Anita Ekberg, I don't think. She just made a movie called The Dwarf or The Red Dwarf or something, where she has sex with a dwarf in it or something. I don't know. But she came back, and I loved her interviews because she was, like, grouchy. And all the press I read, she would go into restaurants, and they'd say, would you like water? And why would I want water? I want wine, which I thought was great. She would just have a fit about wine in every interview.
So in your movie, Cecil B. DeMented and his gang kidnap Melanie Griffith, and they force her to star in this subversive
in this underground
film
movie,
that they're
but
making.
Then she becomes one of them and becomes a terrorist against mainstream movies.
Why Melanie Griffith? Why did you choose her?
Well, I had met Melanie Griffith when in a Jonathan Demme movie I was in called Something Wild, where I play a used car salesman and I sell her a used car. I met her the second time at Piazzadora's birthday party. I met her the third time at the San Sebastian Film Festival. And I still didn't really know her, but I suspected that she had to have a sense of humor. And then I saw the Larry Clark movie, Another Day in Paradise, where she shoots up in her neck and other areas. And I thought, well, she's taking chances. So we had a meeting, and she was great. She came to the meeting with no makeup on a skull T-shirt. Confidence. I thought that was great. And Antonio, her husband, had certainly come from Pedro Almodovar's movies, so I thought he might be sympathetic, and I think he was. I think he was very much behind her during this movie also. And she had a sense of humor, and we had what they call that Hollywood meeting where you just go and psych each other out and see if you can stand each other for 4 months. And I think she's quite good in the movie. I'm quite happy with it.
Have you ever approached a Hollywood star who was appalled at the idea of being in one of your films?
I'm sure I have, but generally I wouldn't hear that. The agents say it. You know, what that mean, go to hell, they translate it to it. She passes. That's like when your movie flops, they say that. You know, it lowballed it. They always have these ridiculous Hollywood words. My most hideous new Hollywood word I heard was, they're frenemies.
Wow.
They're people that sue each other but have lunch. That's called a frenemies. That was a gagger. Wow. That was a new one I heard.
John Waters is my guest, and his new movie is called Cecil B. Demented. Now, did you grow up feeling the same kind of antagonism toward Hollywood that is expressed in this movie?
Because you loved movies. I still love Hollywood. You know, I've always made fun of things I love in my movies. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I had never thought I would ever be in Hollywood. I wanted to make, in the beginning, the best underground movie I could make. After that, the best midnight movie I could make. I guess after that, the best, we didn't call them independent movies, but best low-budget movie. And then when I made a Hollywood movie, I tried to make fun of a Hollywood movie. So, and I don't know what I'm making today. It's all those things put together because the movie business is so, there's a real gray area, what's a Hollywood movie and what isn't today. They're the same almost. So, no, I liked Hollywood. We mocked Hollywood in even the star system I had in my early film. I didn't have friends. I wasn't famous. So we thought up these personas, really, of I was the demented director in a way, and Divine was the, you know, my inflated Jane Mansfield. And we even had almost a vaudeville act. When I would show my early movies, we would go to each city, and I would come out looking like a deranged pimp hippie, basically, and introduce the most beautiful woman in the world. And Divine would come out dressed as the Divine character, pushing a shopping cart with dead mackerels in it and throw it in the audience. Then we would hire the cutest hippie in each city, and we had this police outfit that we had stolen, and we would dress him in that on a short-haired wig, and then he'd come out and try to arrest Divine, and Divine would strangle him to death. And that was our act. It was like vaudeville. We did it at midnight shows all the time. So that was the only way we could promote the films. We didn't have any money.
You know, in your movie, the gang of filmmakers breaks into a lot of movie theaters. Mm-hmm. They get into a kung fu house, and the kung fu audience is on their side.
Yeah.
So what do you think of kung fu movies and the kung fu audience? What connection do you feel?
Well, generally, I used to go to that theater, the Patterson, was the real kung fu theater, one of them in Baltimore. All the movie theaters in the theaters are the real theaters I grew up in. They're mostly closed now. But I would go to karate things. Usually it was mostly all men by themselves, usually on probation. And they would like Cecil because he was a criminal, not because he was an arty director. Because as one even says to Melanie, sign my parole card. Now, I've signed people's parole cards at book signing, and I always find it touching. And also in those theaters where rats used to be. And I actually used to see rats run where people would just laugh and put their feet up. So this is real memories that did happen to me. I think a karate audience, you know, and this is even more bizarre because in Cecil B. Demented, the karate audience saves Cecil B. Demented from the G-rated family audiences that are chasing them and trying to arrest them. Then Cecil escapes and goes to a porno theater. And in the porno theater, the Teamsters try to get Cecil, and the porno fans come to his aid.
You mentioned that the old theaters in which you used to go see movies aren't really movie theaters anymore. And you have a whole kind of collage of those old movie theaters in Cecil B. Demented. And one of them's a VFW post, and one of them's a big discount store. And that certainly happened in Philadelphia and some of the theaters, too. Does it break your heart when you see an old movie theater that's now a discount store?
Does it break my heart? I'm not that nostalgic. I think what it is I like them there as ghosts. I hate it when they take the marquee down. I don't mind if it's closed, boarded up, and the marquee gets worse and worse every year and rots and the glass breaks and there's the three letters left are crooked and then there's one letter left. That's kind of fascinating to me. And that was what the Hippodrome was like in Baltimore, where they hide out. And there's another theater in Baltimore called The Town that we filmed in. And in that theater, I always remember I was probably the last paying customer. I went there right up to the end where they had the most disreputable movies with the scariest audience you ever saw in your life. And someone had carved in the lobby on the wall like graffiti, "If you come through this door, you be kilt, K-I-L-T." And the management didn't take it down, which I thought was really kind of, well, I guess the thrill of going to a horror movie, it was even scarier, you know, because you were scared about the movie and you were scared the audience would kill you. It was really an exciting experience movie going in those days.
What qualifies as a scary movie audience for you?
Well, scary movie audiences are basically people that when there's a lot of violence yell out, "I want to see more green." I had never heard of that term. Green is gore. I didn't know that. Or basically that are talking to themselves loudly that have nothing to do with the movie. People that have been on day passes from mental institutions. Or if the ticket price is cheap enough where people live there, basically that is their hotel. It gives a certain edge to the movie going experience.
Did you ever see one of your films with an audience that you felt was having an inappropriate response to your scenes?
No, my films don't work in exploitation audiences, I'm ashamed to say. We tried it. It doesn't work because there's irony. And they smell a rat correctly, and the rat is me. They work the best in the richest, smartest neighborhoods, I'm embarrassed to admit.
That's funny, actually. But I could see how what you're saying would be
true. Inappropriate? Well, in the old days with my movies, they try to get publicity by saying that certain theaters would put sawdust down because they said that people vomited. Well, they did, but not from the movie. They were just drunk. But I took credit. I didn't reveal that for many years later.
My guest is John Waters. His new movie, Cecil Be Demented, has just come out on video and DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Waters. His new movie, Cecil Be Demented, is about a group of subversive filmmakers who make this underground movie that they hope will destroy commercial cinema, and they come pretty close to destroying it along the way. Now, the Hollywood movie star they kidnapped to star in their movie is played by Melanie Griffith. And one of the things you have her do in the movie, you set her hair on fire.
Yes.
Now, the actress that Melanie Griffith plays in the movie isn't very happy about this. I imagine Melanie Griffith herself wasn't very happy about it either.
I didn't have any trouble with that because it was a stunt woman's hair caught on fire.
Oh, of course.
And then it's superimposed with her face.
Now, I'm almost surprised that you would allow...
Well, I'll tell you,
stunt actor to do it and not force Melanie Griffith to do it herself.
Well, this is based on a real story in a real weird way. When we were making Pink Flamingos, where Divine ate dog feces, Mink Stoll in it was playing Connie Marble, and she was challenging her. And I said to her then, "Mink, would you set your hair on fire?" And she very wisely said, "No." I don't know what I was thinking. I was so nuts then that I thought, well, I never thought about special effects. I thought, well, just throw a bucket of water on, I'll be fine. And it became kind of legend, you know, with all the people I work with. The girl who said no, like, isn't there a book called that now about Call You Vine? The girl who said, she said no. So Mink did very wisely, thank God, I'd probably be in prison and she'd look like Mask.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
but right. So it was sort of, in a way, remembering that and sort of an homage to Mink's very wise decision to say no to me at that time. And I don't know what I was thinking about. I was just demented, I guess. I didn't mean it to. I never thought Mink would be hurt. The last thing I'd want to do was hurt her. I was just carried away in my filthiness, you know. It was a battle of filth. So I remembered that. And of course, Melanie was not so uptight about that because, as I say, it was a stunt woman's hair on fire and it was put together with special effects. She was more uptight in having to look in the beginning how she looks in the movie. It was much more horrifying to her. I mean, you think about it, she is the Revlon woman, and then we made her look with her hair set on fire. It's all frizzled out, and she has, like, punk makeup on and everything. I think she looks great. I think she looks more beautiful than the Revlon girl to me. But it's two very, very different universes she's starring in.
Gee, you were pretty irresponsible as a young filmmaker.
Well, that's probably the most irresponsible, although maybe I would have realized if she had said yes when, as we started to do it, that we shouldn't do this. It never got that far.
As her eyes and nose started to melt.
Yeah, there was another scene where Cookie said no to her, Cookie Muller, wisely. There was a scene that got cut out where she was supposed to go in with a TV while it was on and just smash it with an axe. And she wisely called TV stores, and they said, don't do that, it'll explode and everything. And, you know, I don't know, I just didn't think of special effects then, obviously. If I had in the Divine scene, it certainly, we wouldn't be talking about that scene today if it was like Salo, where they use chocolate.
No, I know you've been wanting to make Cecil B. Demented for years, because I remember you talking about it, I forget how long ago.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if any of your ideas changed over time, if the things you wanted to satirize in the movie changed as Hollywood changed.
Well, certainly when I wrote Cecil B. Demented was before Pecker, so it was really about 5 years ago when I first thought it up. I did satirize new movies, the sequel to Forrest Gump, the director's cut of Patch Adams. I certainly did new drafts of it afterwards. But at the same time, a lot of it was the same. I forget, you know, when you look at the first draft and then you look at the shooting script, certainly things have changed. I loved it. At one time, one of the French distributors, their notes to me were, make it weirder. I thought, oh my God, finally, this is the best. That's never happened in my whole life. It's usually the complete opposite, where you can't have this, you can't have this. So, I mean, that's how much the business has changed, really. And this is an international business, certainly. My films would never be financed if they couldn't play everywhere in the world, all around the world. That's the only reason they do, because they're modestly successful everywhere in the world, which is enough on my budgets.
Do you go to other countries and watch how your movies play to audiences there?
Well, certainly I've gone to film festivals, yes. The only time I'm against dubbing, but I'm fascinated when I watch them dubbed, because I can't believe that, I don't know, and some of the things to translate is very, very hard. You know, I even did a glossary for Pecker explaining what each one of these obscure American things meant in English so they could translate it. And even on Cecil B. DeMented, when it showed in Cannes this year, the French spent a lot of time with the subtitles to make sure they were very good. And the translator called me and said, the only thing we can't translate here is the fact that the French could never understand the concept of a director's cut. Every film is a director's cut in France. It's a sacrilege. They invented auteurs. So it's an inconceivable idea to the French that there would be a cut of a film that the director didn't approve.
John Waters, his latest movie, Cecil B. Demented, has just come out on video and DVD. Our interview was recorded last summer. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm not a juvenile delinquent.
No, no.
Coming up, John Waters talks about his youth spies, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Shadow of the Vampire.
Do the thing that's right, you'll do nothing wrong. Life will be so nice, you'll be in paradise. I know, because I'm not a juvenile delinquent. So listen, boys and girls, you need not be blue. Life is what you make of it, it all depends on you. I know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director John Waters. He started his career making movies that were shocking and hilarious in their bad taste. His latest movie, Cecil B. Demented, has just been released on video and DVD. It's about a director who's more extreme than Waters himself. Demented is an independent director who declares war on mainstream movies, kidnaps a Hollywood star, and forces her to be the heroine of his anti-Hollywood film. John Waters' other movies include Pink Flamingos, Polyester, Hairspray, and Pecker. You are in your mid-50s now, I think.
54.
54. Do you still relate to, like, rebellious youth culture?
Certainly. Way so. More, very much so. Like the Seattle riots. I thought, oh, God, I felt nostalgic. Kids should riot every once in a while. I think each generation should have their own riots. Very much so. I have youth spies, people that tell me new groups. You have to. You know, I give them drinks and bars, and if they, you know, tell me a couple of new good groups, and then I go home and listen to them. But then I don't have to go out till 4 in the morning.
Now, you've always liked real outlaw, you know, music, whether it's because it's really noisy or there's violent lyrics or
whatever. I like all kinds of music.
Right, yeah, oh, yeah. You like novelty dance hits.
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah. So you have everything from, like, you know, rap to Liberace.
To psycho punk band, especially the Locust.
On the soundtrack of your movie. Why Liberace?
Well, Liberace's always been a terrorist in his own right. And at the end of the movie, Melanie has kind of lost her mind.
Is it a terror of sequins or something?
Well, but he is a terrorist because, to me, his appeal has never totally been explained, that all elderly women love him and don't think he's gay. I mean, Liberace did sue a paper for saying he was gay and win. Isn't that terrorism? And, you know, when he died, that same paper in London sued the estate to get the money back.
Did they win?
I don't know that. Oh. I'm sure they settled. I just went to the Liberace Museum in Las Vegas for the first time last weekend. It was great. I always liked Liberace. And I met him at the end. I wrote kind of a smart-aleck review of his book, The Things I Love, for Vogue magazine. But he called me and said, oh, we love the review. We love it. And come to this dinner. And I did, and I was so thrilled. I'm all for Liberace. I loved, even his boyfriend wrote a book called Behind the Candelabra, which I think it should have been Beneath. But my favorite thing in it was supposedly Liberace abuse, that Liberace forced him to have a facelift to look like Liberace. I love that. I want to start doing that now. You have an appointment. Time to get up. Don't be sitting around that pool all day. Remember Dr. So-and-so at 2 o'clock. Oh, it's just so surreal. It's my favorite kind of celebrity abuse I've ever heard, for your boyfriend or girlfriend to have to be forced to turn into you through plastic surgery. So great.
Liberace sings on the
he track. He sings a song called Chow.
Yeah, I haven't heard him sing before. I didn't realize he sang.
Oh, yeah, he can sing. And this was, from what I gather, another great music spy in Baltimore who's helped me a lot, named Larry, had this record. And it was originally, from what I can gather, a ad for a perfume called Chow. And it was the commercial. But I really believe that if Melanie Griffith was losing her mind and being led to a police wagon, in her head, she might be saying, don't say goodbye, say ciao. It's so nauseating, this song, that it's almost like tripping when you hear it to me. I mean, it's hallucinogenic. It's so schmaltzy. And it's Liberace at his best and his worst and his most confusing.
Well, we can only pause now and listen to it.
Say goodbye, say ciao. Till we meet again, say ciao. Though the time has come for us to part, you always will remain within my heart. So please don't shed a tear, say ciao. You'll be always near somehow. Time will disappear, so hold me dear and never say goodbye, say ciao. When words are hard to find, to say what's on.
That's Liberace singing Ciao from the soundtrack of John Waters' movie Cecil B. Demented. Now, the target of your movie, Cecil B. Demented, is commercial cinema.
I might disagree a little with you on that.
Okay, disagree, and then I'll ask my question. Oh, you're done disagreeing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But it seems to me independent film has a lot of sins to answer for
well, I was
now.
Just gonna,
oh, okay, good.
They're bad independent movies, just as much whiny Cecil what might blow up Sundance. I mean, what I'm saying is he's too insane. He doesn't like any movies but his own. He would criticize completely independent films too about your grandmother and what a wonderful person she was. I would say that Cecil's beyond. He's all movies get on his nerves that aren't radical enough. And the same way I feel, I don't judge a film if I like it or not by its budget. I can love an $80 million movie and hate an $80 movie. It doesn't matter so much on how much it costs as what the movie itself is.
How has it affected your film-going habits and stuff to have this like proliferation of independent movies, on low budget, some of which are really interesting and others are just really dull?
Well, when you say interesting, that to me is usually when people, after they see your movie, if they say to you, it was really interesting, that means I hated it.
Right.
And they don't know what else to say. That's the best green room perjury, they call it. It was interesting. Or the other one they say is, you've topped yourself. Because that could mean I hate it, too. There's all different things that you can say at a screening that you learn these buzzwords early. So because you have to go to screenings all the time with people that are in it. And then afterwards, the whole time you're watching it thinking, oh, please be over. I'm going to kill myself. I hate this. Hi, it was interesting.
When you started making movies, there was no independent film circuit. There wasn't a Sundance Film Festival. There wasn't this whole circuit of international film festivals at which you can show independent films. So you had to find places for your movies, and your movies helped create the whole midnight movie circuit.
Well, when I first started, the underground film world I wanted to get into was totally New York-based, and they were very chauvinistic. They wouldn't even look at my movies because I was from Baltimore. And New York was the last place my movie played after I'd made Mondo Trasho and Multiple Maniacs. None of them played till after Pink Flamingos became a success in New York. They had played in L.A., San Francisco, Provincetown, Philadelphia. They had played in it, and everywhere but New York. So there was nobody looking for my kind of movie then, believe me. And nobody said they were good, except finally Fran Lebowitz, and one of her first things she ever wrote for Interview Magazine. Nobody liked them. But in those days, they were square critics, so it helped us. We used all the negative reviews. That could never, ever happen today. Even on Serial Mom, I believe, we got two thumbs down, and I wanted to put that in the ad with all the good reviews and two thumbs down. They wouldn't. It can't happen today because all film critics are hip. Nobody's rising to any bait. They're too smart. And in those days when all the critics would say a septic tank explosion, it must be seen, or the most filthy, worst movie ever made, that helped us. That's impossible today. That couldn't happen, and it couldn't help me. Well, if anything, it hurts me because that's my competition. My old movies I bet there'll never be one review of this movie that doesn't mention my old movies in the first paragraph. That happened last time. It happens every time now.
Right.
So that's okay. They remember my old movies.
Is there anything left of the midnight movie circuit?
No. I don't think to make a midnight movie is suicide, because where would you show it? I mean, I'm sure Rocky
exactly,
Horror still plays somewhere, and people, the last of the cult still comes in dressed as those outfits. But believe me, those people are not exactly cutting edge.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but I guess you really couldn't do like the midnight movie thing in the multiplex.
You don't need to, because you play 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 in a big commercial chain now if you had Rocky Horror.
Right.
Every movie theater is looking for the next Blair Witch, the next Gummo, the next Pink Flamingos. They're looking for the next weirdo movie from nowhere.
Now, is that part of what you mean when you say in your movie, when Cecil B. DeMille says the Hollywood system stole our sex and co-opted our violence, so there's nothing left for us to do?
Well, in a way, that's true, except I think what they really did was end all exploitation. I mean, there's blaxploitation, sexploitation, and violent movies. Once Hollywood made them, those genres were gone. I mean, Shaving Ryan's Privates. That's a porno movie. And I get them mixed up. But Saving, what's the real title? I can't even remember anymore.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. was a gore film, really. Without Herschel Gordon Lewis, we could have never had that. The first 20 minutes were blood feast, basically. It would have been exploitation.
Did you see Shaving Ryan's Privates?
Yes, I saw both. Shaving Ryan's Private spoke to me more.
Did you go to a theater or see it on video?
I saw it on the video, actually. I'm really for people to go to porno theaters. In person, it's for the VCR impaired.
There aren't many left.
Well, there's one we shot in Baltimore, The Apex, where the Alicia Witt porno movie is playing. And I was really happy. It's a porno theater at peace with the community. And it's made friends, and there's churches around and everything. It's been there forever. So I was afraid the marquee says an all anal evening, and I was afraid to put the L up until the last minute. I didn't want him to get in trouble with the neighbors, so I just had an all ana evening, and people kept saying, "What's that mean?" And then just when we did the shot, I put the L in because I didn't want to get him in trouble with the neighbors.
My guest is John Waters. His new movie, Cecil B. Demented, has just come out on video and DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and director John Waters. His latest movie, Cecil B. Demented, has just come out on video and DVD.
I want to get back to what we were talking about keeping up with bands and with youth culture and stuff. Are there things about pop culture today, like youth-oriented pop culture today, that kind of alienate you, that you're really uninterested in?
Well, let me think. I'm sure there is, but like what? Music, no. I like gangster rap. I like techno music. I like K-hole music. I like that.
K-hole music.
Yeah, they get in a K-hole when they took too much Special K. I have that in the movie where you do the same motion over and over. You can't get out of it. That's like an overdose on these designer drugs they all take now. Yeah. I have to spy on drugs, too, the drug culture. There's new drugs I've never even heard of that people take. I mean, I'm an old fogey. The last one, really, the new drugs sound horrible to me. Who would want to take ecstasy and love everybody? God, it sounds like hell to me. So I'm not tempted to take drugs anymore. These new ones just sound like the worst kind of possible experience, like running up to people I hate and going, "I love you. I want to hear what happened to me as a child." Oh, God, help. So, like what? Like, tell me what that gets on your nerves, that alienates you in
youth
culture.
No, I was wondering if there's any bands that are, like, really popular that you feel like people expect you to like that you really don't.
Oh, you mean like NSYNC are the most really popular ones that are so mainstream? I find them kind of clever. I mean, to me, I like seeing them. I don't even know what they sound like. I've never heard NSYNC in my life. Or I probably have and don't know it. But I don't like Hanson. I love how they look. I like to read about them. I don't have to hear them. I like to see their image and what they do with that image. I kind of am interested in all that by reading. I'm a total magazine junkie. I get like 120, I think, now, magazines a month. And I read them all, so I know about all these TV people. I've never seen the show, but I know who they are, but I don't know what they do, really, because I just read who they're marrying or who they're having affairs with. But I know famous people for all the wrong reasons, for the bad things in their life.
Right. I'm not sure if I've asked you this before or not, but some of the actors and actresses who you've worked with over the years have been very extreme in how they dress and do their hair, and Divine being the best example of that. And you don't fit into that category yourself, at least not now. For example, you're wearing a striped shirt with a jacket and slacks.
Well, Divine didn't look like Divine in real life either.
Right.
When we were young, we looked like lunatics. We dressed.
Nothing's pierced on your face.
No, nothing's pierced.
No
if
tattoos,
I was young.
No tattoos in sight.
No, I have no tattoos. If I was young, I would have had piercings, I'm sure, because I had very long hair when I was young, which was the piercings of that day for a man. I'd like piercings. I think kids look cute with the eyebrow piercing. I tell the parents, don't worry about the piercing. They grow back. It's the tattoos that look bad, no matter how butch, no matter how sexy you are at 20. Your tattoos at 50 will make you look very worn out, and somebody's going to make a fortune taking them all off, all these kids. But I think tattoos can look good, especially if you're a convict. It's a good look, especially if you're released. It is a certain edge it adds to it. But I'm against, like, pretty tattoos. I like ones that are just all black. That's my favorite new one, because that really hurts. Just a solid big band of all black. That's the kind I like.
But outside of like long hair, have you ever been into the theater of presentation, the theater of how
God,
you look?
Oh, yes. When I was young, I used to wear a silver holster with a gun and spurs, a silver leather jacket. I had like yellow wraparound bug sunglasses. I used to wear cowboy shirts from thrift shops that had padded guitars all over them. I had a shirt that had shrunken heads on it.
Did your parents ever send you to a psychiatrist when you were young?
Yes. Well, they had to. When I was expelled from college, they said he needs extensive psychiatric treatment. They always used to say I needed psychiatric treatment. Yeah, I went. And those shrinks, it didn't work because I didn't want to go. Later, when I went on my own, it worked. I mean, well, my version of working. My version of mental health, which is what you see here today.
Why did you go on your own?
Well, because I was like feeling unhappy about a few things, which I don't usually feel. So it was good. And I went back for a touch-up once.
So when you were sent against your will to the psychiatrist, yeah. What was their approach?
Well, the only reason I went was to get out of the Army because I figured that I was nuts. And this is when they had the draft. And I went through the whole thing. And I would begrudgingly go. And then I got my draft notice, and the shrink said, John, I believe the Army would be the best thing in the world for you.
Oh,
I
no.
thought, you quack. Right, because I knew I could get out of the Army. It was easy. I said I was gay. I wet my bed. I was a junkie. I checked every single thing, and then the guy said to me, is this true, with this look of disgust on his face? And I, with a casual toss of my long, oily, thin hair, said, yeah. And got sent home. I didn't even have to take the physical. Now, today I know we got to fight for gay rights and we got to join the Army. That's the last place I want to be, is get married or join the Army. I don't get it. Maybe that's how I feel alienated from youth culture. Although, if straight people can have 7 bad marriages, gay people should be allowed at least 1 good one.
So, were you making movies at that time already when you got out of
the air? Yeah, I made the first one when I was 17, right after I was expelled from NYU. No, I had made one before that in high school. Then I went away to college, and yes, I had made 1 8mm movie that was, if you could call it a movie, I use the term loosely.
Do you have any home movies at home?
Yeah, this one.
No, I mean...
Half my films.
No, but I mean, like movies your parents made of you growing
yes.
up, your birthday parties.
They had some of that was in Steve Yeager's documentary about me, Divine Trash,
yeah.
and In Bad Taste. They have some of that. Yeah, those footage are in there. But yes, 8mm movies my parents have, certainly. I don't have them.
How do you feel when you see those?
Well, you look at it, and it looks so happy. When you look, you think, why do I ever need to go to a shrink? You know, I'm with my parents in a nice house. My parents never did anything that horrible I can remember. Why am I this nuts?
What were your birthday parties like?
Oh, themes. I had pirate parties where I got to be Captain Hook. I had a pirate party every year so I could be Captain Hook. And once I was the Wicked Witch of the West, the only time I was ever in drag in my entire life. And just because I wanted to be green. I didn't care about the dress. I wanted to have green skin. And I was always a Disney villain every year, and I had costume parties a lot, certainly. And they do have pictures of that, the pirate party, and I was Captain Hook, and I always put that coat hanger. It's a great game. I've taught my nieces and nephews to play it. Take a coat hanger, you bend it, and you put it up your sleeve, and you, too, can have a hook. And it's a good look. A hook adds a definite edge to a dull outfit.
Do you know what your next movie is going to be?
Well, and sort of I do, but I haven't written it yet. I'm just beginning. I have notebooks, and I have millions of notes and pictures torn out. I want to do a movie that takes place, again, very much in the real blue-collar world about sex addicts and how they deal with their problems in the community. And I think it's going to be called A Dirty Shame, because I love that. In Baltimore, people's mothers always used to say, that's a dirty shame what happened to so-and-so. Meaning not that, but just it was an expression I really like. It'd be a great trailer, you know, you show different people, and then it's a dirty shame about each one. People in the neighborhood saying, that's a dirty shame what happened to her.
That reminds me of a fake movie title that you use in Cecil B. Demented, which is Some Kind of Happiness.
Yeah.
Where'd you get the title from?
I don't know. I just had to think up like sappy titles of romantic movies. Although I feel that I have some kind of happiness. I think it
what
sounds.
Kind?
I don't know. Some kind. To me, it sounds like a very Douglas Sirk title.
Oh, yeah.
All That Heaven Allows, or that kind of 50s kind of thing, titles that they don't have anymore. Tennessee Williams always had such good titles, you know. I mean, and they don't have those kind of titles that are long, that don't really mean anything. Like, I don't know, like, Bus Riley's back in town. I mean, there's some great titles, like The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. William Inge had great titles. We don't have those kind of drama titles anymore.
Well, I want to thank you so much, John Waters, for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back in person with you.
John Waters' latest movie, Cecil B. Demented, has just come out on video and DVD. Our interview was recorded last summer. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, Shadow of the Vampire. This is Fresh Air. Shadow of the Vampire is a new film about the making of the silent film classic Nosferatu. John Malkovich stars as F.W. Murnau, the director of Nosferatu, and Willem Dafoe plays the mysterious actor Max Schreck, who starred in Murnau's film as the vampire Count Orlok. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Just 2 years ago, the off-slighted Orson Welles came in for some trashing in Tim Robbins' The Cradle Will Rock. Now, Shadow of the Vampire, which is at least a better movie, take some cheap shots at the pioneering German filmmaker F.W. Murnau. It takes an old myth about the actor who starred in Murnau's 1922 vampire tale, Nosferatu, and uses it to hammer away at Murnau in particular and directors in general. To do so, the filmmakers have had to completely distort the historical Murnau's character, turning him from the reserved, good-tempered, and even charming figure he actually was into a B-movie caricature of a mad scientist. Nosferatu was adapted from the novel Dracula with some alterations. Among the most significant was the figure of the vampire, who, unlike the suave continental figure in the book, was bald, big-eared, cadaverous, and rat-like in the movie. The vampire, rechristened Count Orlok, was played by Max Schreck, an obscure, if physically striking performer who has remained a mysterious figure over the years. Adding to his tantalizing lack of biography, his name was an obvious pseudonym. Schreck is the German word for fright or terror. Screenwriter Stephen Katz, who is the originator of Shadow of the Vampire, based his story on decades of persistent, lighthearted speculation that Schreck really was a vampire. In the movie, Murnau is a crazed perfectionist whose pursuit of realism has driven him into forbidding Eastern European mountains where he finds an actual vampire. The filmmaker offers the monster a deal. If he will portray his blood-sucking kind in a movie, the director will let him actually feast on his leading lady at the movie's climax. Shadow of the Vampire begins with the first day of Nosferatu's shoot and goes on to detail the problems of working with a real vampire, most of which arise from his unslakable thirst. These problems can be funny, and thanks to Willem Dafoe's intelligent and surprisingly open interpretation of the vampire, simultaneously frightful, endearing, and sad. Taking his cues from Katz's script, Dafoe emphasizes the monster's advanced age, making him a cranky observer of his own decrepitude. The short-tempered Schreck even argues with John Malkovich's Murnau over his out-of-control eating habits, which have started to foul members of the crew.
How dare you! How dare you destroy my photographer! You idiot!
Did I kill some of your people, Murnau? I can't remember.
We have an arrangement.
Don't pretend you mourn, Herr Doctor. I know you.
Why him, you monster? Why not the script girl?
The script girl?
I'll eat her later.
No, you will not. Our bargain. You agreed not to hurt my people. Listen to me. Do you understand? This requires that I go back to Berlin to find another photographer and then to fly him back here. And you, you will control yourself while I am away.
I don't think we need the writer any longer.
I don't expect you to understand this, and I am loath to admit it myself. But the writer is necessary. All my crew is necessary. Do you understand?
As you can tell, Katz is operating from a certain amount of professional resentment. Murnau's grudging protection of his own writer is a satirical jab at writer-director relationships. Director E. Elias Merige, whose previous feature was the creepily effective experimental film Begotten, largely plays off Defoe's vampire, turning the movie into a visually clever character fantasy. While Murnau went to great lengths to shoot on location, Merige concentrates on the extravagant possibilities offered by stage sets, with their odd perspectives so suited for theatrical entrances and exits. Unfortunately, we can't follow these stylistic flourishes to the point of ignoring Malkovich's Murnau. Malkovich doesn't really turn in a character study. He just does another of his madman bits, offering a familiar mix of intense stares and loud, abrupt line readings. The problem isn't just a banal performance by Malkovich. It's the banal conception that underlies it. Shadow wants to shock us with the notion that film directors are monsters themselves, that they suck the life out of their collaborators in an ego-driven creative frenzy. There's nothing in Murnau's career to support such a charge. It's more like a masochistic fantasy of cowed and aggrieved writers stewing in their own powerlessness. And that fantasy is one Shrek that needs a stake driven through its heart.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. We'll close with the music of Jack McDuff, who played soul jazz on the Hammond B3 organ. He died Tuesday in a Minneapolis nursing home of an apparent heart attack, which followed a series of small strokes. He was 74.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Edith Story, the true story of one girl's courage and survival during World War II by Edith Vellmans. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the brain, memory, and Alzheimer's disease. We talk to neurogeneticist Rudolf Tanzi, who has been researching the cause of Alzheimer's disease since the 80s. His new book is called Decoding Darkness. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.